Good afternoon. So last time we started by finishing up talking about signal handling, mentioning a bit about how kill, when we're killing another process, sending a signal to another process, that you know might not actually take effect immediately. Kill just makes it so it's going to happen eventually. The signals running the signal handler or the signal causing the process to terminate, but maybe not before kill returns. Then we started talking about sort of access control and permissions. So we talked about having things like files and operations we don't want to allow everyone to do, like shutting down a machine or accessing devices. And we need some way of controlling that. And as part of this, the operating system needs to keep track of, like, each program I'm running, what it is allowed to do. And the mechanism we had for doing that was this idea of user IDs and group IDs, that we'd have an ID that represents typically whoever's running the program, but it's not required to represent that, and some groups that typically represent sort of what class of person the person running the program is, but don't have to. But these numbers that are tracked for every program by the operating system kernel and used to make decisions about what system calls do we return errors from, saying you can't do that, versus what system calls do we make work normally. And we mentioned that on sort of the classic Unix design, these have names, but they aren't actually tracked by the kernel. The kernel just tracks these numbers and is comparing numbers, and there's just some libraries that handle mapping that to names, making things convenient for us. And we have some database that's typically only accessible, or only modifiable by the system administrator that sort of tracks that mapping. And we had these kind of two different mechanisms for setting up who could access files. That's typically the sort of kind of most important case where what user you are on a system comes up. And Unix kind of has these two mechanisms, the one that works everywhere with chmod, and kind of a more flexible mechanism with access control lists, which is also kind of what Windows supports. And as you'll see in the lab tomorrow, it is supported sometimes on our portal and sometimes not supported on portal. So for chmod permissions, we get to specify one user ID who's also the owner and therefore the one with access to change these settings, and one group ID and a default. And for each of those sort of sets of people, we specify whether they can read, write, or execute the file or directory in question, where for directories, execute means sort of access files in that directory. And reading and writing is referring to modifying the list of files or reading the list of files in that directory. And then we had access control lists, and those are kind of a generalization of the chmod idea. Chmod, we have one user we can specify read, write, execute for, one group, and a default. With access control list, the more general form of access control list, we aren't limited to specifying one user, we aren't limited to specifying one group, we can specify as many as we like. So another issue we need to talk about with sort of permissions was sort of how do we sort of set our user IDs initially, and how do we deal with letting users do things that we normally reserve for system administrators in a kind of selective basis. And so one thing we need is we need some way of having some, way where programs can run, where they can do extra stuff. And on Unix, what they've chosen to do is have a user ID 0 be special, called root or super user. And basically, they've decided that when we're checking permissions, no matter what the chmod says or the access control list says, if you are user ID 0, we just say, yep, you can do it. And this includes things like changing the user ID associated with your process. So when you're stepping up to a machine and typing your username and password, there's going to be a program on a Unix system running as user ID 0. It's going to check your password and because it's running as user ID 0, it can change all the user IDs, so it's going to change a user ID to the one you're running as before starting your shell or your desktop environment, whatever you're logging into. And we also have this mechanism of set user ID programs, that on Unix you can mark an executable as being what's called set user ID, and so called because when that executable runs, the operating system, while it's running it, will change the user ID of the program to be the owner of the executable, rather than the default, which is that if I run a program, typically it runs with the user ID I started with. But here we'll change the user ID. This is most commonly used to change that user ID to user ID 0. And the idea is that the system administrator can install a program that lets users do things they normally can't do. So like they can install a program that lets users reboot the machine. By just having a program that when you run it reboots the machine, normally if users ran that, it would say, no, users can't reboot the machine because we don't want to allow just anyone to reboot the machine. But if the system administrator installs that and marks it as set user ID, they can run it and it will run as user ID 0. So the operating system will say, yep, your user ID 0, you can do that. This is used for lots of kind of special operations we want. You might want to selectively allow users to do. It gives the system administrators control over that without needing to modify the code that runs in kernel mode itself. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So some trivia. So we had a question about anonymous feedback asking, could we have more office hours earlier in the week? We probably should have some office hours in future weeks, Tuesday mornings, which I think will help a little bit. And I'm going to look into what people are doing office hours on Thursdays or Fridays where we would not be really annoyed by having fewer people. There's some times on Thursdays and Fridays where that would definitely be a bad idea to move people from Thursday to like Tuesday. But there's probably some, there might be a few, I can get a few extra times earlier in the week. Another question, hey, so for the timing assignment, one of the things you need to do is deal with what we call overhead. And the question is, why is the overhead, I'm getting the overhead measurement sort of after I try to subtract it out, I'm finding out that things take negative time. And obviously, they aren't really taking negative time. What's going on? So I kind of think there's two kind of things which can be going on here. So one is that I know some students didn't understand what we meant by overhead. So when we're trying to time something, so if let's say here I'm trying to time this task in blue here, we're going to run some function to read a timer, we're going to do the task, and we're going to run some function to read the timer. And that process of reading the timer takes some amount of time. Usually, it's a trivial amount of time, but for some of the things we're supposed to time for the assignment, they're very, very short. So the amount of time to read the timer is actually pretty long. Also, there's going to be some work to like actually start doing the task and finish it, like if you have like a for loop or an if statement or, you know, moving variables around to set up arguments, you know, there might be a little bit of extra work that you're also timing. And our goal is to figure out how long this blue part takes. But your raw measurements are going to be all of this stuff. So when we're talking about overhead in the assignment, we want you to try to subtract out all the non-blue stuff from there. And our recommendation is time doing a task that's nothing. So you have a timing that's hopefully just the yellow and purple parts here, not that actual task you want to time. You can subtract that and use the difference to figure out how long is the blue part only. So even after you've done that, some people have had issues where they've noticed negative times. So there's kind of two things which are going on, I think. So one is that if there's other things going on the machine or things are being loaded into caches, the amount of time things will take will often vary. And this will mean that both your measurement with the task and your overhead measurement will vary. My recommendation for dealing with that is to take multiple measurements and somehow consolidate them into a single, more apt accurate measurement. So this could be by taking an average or trying to find the minimum time instead of the typical time. You know, I think the best solution is to take something like a median. Another thing is that because of things like caches, because things get loaded as your program runs the first time you run things, sometimes it's significantly slower. So if you have a pattern where you're measuring how long this read timer takes, it might be slower the first time, in which case you'll have this kind of systematic bias where your first measurement's always really long, and when you subtract that from a second measurement with the task, it gets always negative. And you can avoid that by making sure you take enough measurements that nothing is changing about how long things take from the operating system sort of loading your program into caches and other fast memory. Talk more about sort of how caches work later in the semester, which will make that clearer, but the sort of summary is that, like, often the first time things are run, things are kind of still being loaded onto the machine and will be a little slower. Okay, so questions on overhead for the timing assignment? And then, do you mind going over what the read, write, and execute permissions allow? Okay, so for regular files, the read permission allows you to open the file for reading, any kind of reading. This includes reading and writing. You do need the read permission to do that. Writing allows you to open the file to write or print, do anything that modifies the contents, the data in the file. That requires the write permission. And execute allows you to run the file as a program. So to have it as your .slash file name and have that succeed. For directories, this is, I think, where things people get most confused by this, by what the write, read and write permissions mean. So for directories, reading means listing the directory contents, and writing means modifying the directory contents, so adding files, removing files, renaming files, and so on. And the execute permission, which is called search on directories, allows accessing a file or subdirectory in that directory if you already know its name. So you can't, like, read the list of files, but if you know if there's a file called foo, you can access it if you have the search permission on the directory. Some questions? Yes?
So if you had a file that only had, like, a write permission but no read permission, would that mean, like, you could only change the contents of the file, like, outside of the file?
The question, if I had a file which only had the write permission but no read permission, that could that mean I could only change the contents of the file outside of the file? That would mean you can only change the contents of the file. So the way this would be enforced is that when you try to open the file, you would be allowed to open it for writing, any kind of anything that involves writing, but not anything that involves reading. So you can open it for any type of writing, but not any type of reading, and including not reading and writing. That would not be allowed. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Okay, and I'll briefly go over two things on the quiz that seemed a little tricky. So we had one question in the quiz about single handlers, which was asking, we have this program which sets up a single handler for SIGINT, which is triggered by Control C, and sometimes someone observed it didn't seem to work. What was going on? And the reason, case where it definitely would not work, is when the single handler wasn't set up yet. And notably, I think something people were confused about is that once you call SIG action, unless something else calls SIG action or a similar function again, the signal handler is still there. So it's still going to be the case that Control C will go to that signal handler until something calls another function like SIG action. It's not like you know, only in the function after where you call SIG action. It's just as long as the program keeps running, that setting is still in place. Some questions about quiz question on signals? Yes.
I have a question about the previous question about the writing to a file. If you have write-only permission, then do you override every single time you write?
Question: if you have write-only permission, do you override every single time? You can, when you open a file for writing, after you do that, you can seek to wherever you want in the file still. That is not restricted by the permissions. So you could write to overwrite to the beginning of the file, or you could skip to somewhere in the middle of the file and write there. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So I looked at fgets, and I saw that it was async and not save, because you argued that if you run the process, that if you press Control C to the process, that fgets would run it down on the process and crash.
So the question is, isn't there a problem where the program might be crashing because fgets dot async equals save? I agree. The question asks, when will this happen, not when might this happen. But yes, I agree that is a concern.
So you have to choose the one that's 100% inevitable.
Yes, or explaining none of the above. If you explain in your comments, we should give you credit for it. But the phrasing of the question is like, what will cause this to happen? And there was a none of the above option saying that these are not, you know, not, might not trigger it, basically. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Could you explain how it's sig empty set and then like sa.sa mask, like what that means? Because when I looked it up, it said that like no additional signals will be blocked. So I'd assume that would mean that like if a signal is sent while another one is running, then like another signal handler, like the default one,
so yeah, so the question is, in the kind of boilerplate code we use to handle the signal, we set this SA mask before calling sig action, to which we passed this SA struct. And when you looked it up, you found out that's a list of what signals to block while the signal handler is running. Yeah, so basically when your signal handler runs, the operating system, for your convenience, will automatically basically call sigproc mask before and after the signal handler. And typically, it does this with just the signal that you are handling. So this means that if I press Control C twice in a row, this is guaranteed to not, by default, cause my handler to run within itself. It will have to finish first, and then it will run again. You can ask it to block additional things with the SA mask option. And you can also use one of the SA flags argument in a way you can look up to have it not block even the signal you're handling right now. For the most part, for what we did with signals, this wasn't really relevant because we weren't really concerned about signals happening while we were handling signals. Does that answer your question? So the question is, the sigproc masks automatically included in the code? The effects of sigproc mask, yes.
Okay.
So probably it's something that's done by the kernel code that runs your signal handler.
And that takes care of, like, if Control C is pressed twice.
And question, that takes care of if Control C is pressed twice? That makes sure if Control C is pressed twice that the signal handler won't run within itself.
Okay.
No matter how fast you are at that. Yeah.
For the last line, one sig action is called from one handler to another. Does that mean like if you set up like a signal, if you like set up against the same signal, or if you like do other signals?
Question: how does calling sig action affect other signals? It only affects the handler for the signal you signal number you pass to sig action. Other questions? Okay. So the other quiz question that there was confusion about was quiz question 4, which was asking, we want to use chmod trial permissions to let two users, A and C, have read-only access to something and B have read-write access to something. And the way you can do this with chmod style permissions is you make B the owner of the file and you make A and C be part of a group that you give read permission to the file. And this is because we can specify one user and one group. Yes? Question, was it just asking which users should be part of the group? Yes.
I read it as asking which creators of the file should be using. That the wording was very confusing to me, so I
which like file types we use for this, and assuming that all of them are already.
So you say you're interpreting as which file creator, which owner we should use for this. So the problem with that is that we can't have two owners. And you interpret it as if you wrote a comment about it, we'll probably give you partial credit. I don't think the term group is ambiguous, so I don't think it's full credit. Because we spoke specifically about what groups were in the context of these.
So what's it run by? We kind of confused, but I termed it as owner.
Yeah, so the question is, why was there the runs by phrasing? That's because the program doesn't belong to the group, but the instance of the program that's run by the user. Because like if we both run the shell is running as us, but it's not owned by us, and I wanted to avoid that confusion. Is that, but I know maybe it could have been clearer and still avoided people saying, oh, the programs they're running aren't their programs. Problem. Is that? Yeah, but it should be partial credit at least, and I'll talk to my TAs about how they think we should grade that, and we'll think about it. Yeah?
So when I read the term, make it so programs run by, I interpret that to mean execute. So would it be fair to interpret that those three people, A, C, and B, need to execute permissions in order to?
So the question is, why did they make it so programs run by? Yeah. So I think if we're making so programs run by have particular users, it doesn't matter whether we can execute the file that we want them to have read permission to. And they aren't executing that file to access it. Because they're executing other programs, it's not a program. Does that answer your question? The other reason for that phrasing is that what group IDs your program has isn't technically based on your user ID, right? It's based on what the login program sets your groups as. So I needed to be careful. I couldn't just say make them part of the group because technically the group setting is independent of that. So that was the main reason for that awkward phrasing. Other questions? Yes?
I wanted to ask when you have a user both as the owner and in a group, does it do the owner permissions override the group permissions, or does it try to maximize?
So the question is if I have a user as the owner in a group, do the owner permissions override the group permissions? Yes. Yes, up there. So the question is, in chmod, we can only have one owner, that's the user. When I have a list of users in the more general form of ACLs that is not chmod, are they all owners? No. And typically on a Unix system, there will be an owner plus those extra users are listed and have additional access. Yeah. How do you use chmod to make user and owner? You can't use chmod to do that. The command to do that, command to change the owner of a file is called chown, and the command to change the group of a file is called chgrp. But they work with chmod. Does that answer your question? Yeah. We will read those comments when grading, and if you're describing accurately what to do, we will probably give you full credit.
But my main question was, if it's the owner, then if programs run by the owner, are they assigned to the group, or is it?
The question, are programs run by the owner assigned to the group? It's not going to be necessary if the owner has permissions just by being the owner. Yeah. Question, why couldn't we put B in a group by itself? If B is in a group, we could use that to give B permissions with the group bits in chmod, but then we only have the user bits left over, and we can't have A and C both be the owner.
Yeah, so why can't you just have just B and A?
So the problem is that we want to have, in the case that we have these, to imitate the ACL, we need to have all these permissions on one file at the same time. So the only way we can achieve that with chmod is we need to have A and C in the same group, because that's the only mechanism chmod gives us to have multiple different users have the same permissions, if it's not the default permissions.
But my question is, why can A and C be in a group together, and B isn't like there at all, but B can't be in a group by itself at all with no A and C?
So the question, why can't B be in a group by itself with no A and C? B can, but it doesn't help us achieve these permissions.
But then for answer choice B, then how come B can't be in it at all then? That's because, like, because then B has no permissions, then right? It doesn't exist.
Question, wouldn't B have no permissions if B's not in the group? If B is the owner of the file, B would have the permissions based on the user settings, which we could set up to give them read and write.
But if like B isn't like in the answer choice at all, aren't we to assume that B just doesn't exist then?
If B isn't in the answer choice at all, aren't we to assume that B doesn't exist? The question was only asking about what groups we need. There are other steps that indeed are necessary that involve B to set up these permissions. It wasn't asking about all those steps. Yeah?
Are there ways to make like access control lists like for groups instead of just users?
Are there ways to make access control lists for groups instead of users? Yes. POSIX access control lists, for example, support settings for groups instead of just users.
So then why couldn't you have like the group just by itself in that kind of like...
So the question, why can't we have a B group by itself? This would be true if we were using a general access control list, but the question was asking about using chmod stuff.
Oh, okay.
Okay, other questions? Yeah?
Well, if B is in a group by itself, why couldn't you use the chmod for that and just set, like, because if B is in a group by itself, when would the group be kind of using
Question, if B is in a group by itself, why couldn't we use those chmod to give B the right permissions? We absolutely could, but then we want to give A and C the correct permissions, and we could only do one of them with our remaining user bits.
But if B and C are in the group by itself, how would you give B the permission if it's not the owner? Or like, add extra.
If A and C are in a group, how would we give them the permission? So with chmod, we can set permissions for one group and one user. So, you know, if we want to include A, B, and C, we need to have a group that includes A and C, and we need to account for B somehow. So.
So did you explain how, like, answer choice B works then, by itself, standalone?
How does answer choice B work? That we make B the owner of the file, and give the owner read-write permissions. And we set the single group the file's associated with, the one that contains A and C, and give that group read permissions.
But what I'm confused about is how we know B is the owner if it's just A and C in the group, though, like it doesn't specify that name.
Question, how do we know B is the owner? The question didn't ask who you set the owner as. The question just asked, could we achieve these effects? Could we achieve that read and write access? So you have to infer that the way we do that is by setting B as the owner. Yes?
Like, it didn't ask, like, can we achieve these same permissions just for creating a group? Like, wouldn't you have to do more than just create a group?
Question, wouldn't you have to do more than just create a group? Yes. The question asks, what group would we want to create as part of everything we're doing? But yes, there are other steps, and I don't think I phrased the question to say there were no other steps. Other questions? Okay, and there was one piece of anonymous feedback asking, can I put things on Panopto? I've done so. Also, they wanted captions. Probably I will have the reporter off the website will have captions. Also, if you don't like the players we have, you can download the video MP4 file and use a local player that could be a lot more flexible. Okay, so our main topic for today, which I expected to start earlier, but okay, is gonna be about address translation. So we've shown this picture before, that when we have two programs running, we have This mapping set by the OS, which determines how the addresses they use actually map to the real addresses on the machine. And this is going to be chosen when we do context switches. The OS is going to switch between these mappings depending on which program we're running, and this means that every program has kind of their own memory. And we're going to have some terminology that we're going to use here. So we're going to call the addresses the program uses virtual addresses. And this is going to apply to every single address you use in the program. All your pointers are virtual addresses. This includes your instruction addresses and your data addresses. So it's not just your data addresses, even though most of our examples will focus more on the data side of things, because that's easier to make examples for. We're going to call the addresses that are on the real machine physical addresses. And it's going to turn out that these addresses can have different sizes. And that's because the mapping is going to translate, you know, from one size to the other in the process. And we're going to talk about sort of what format does this mapping have. There are multiple options for that, and there are factors of machines that use different ways of representing this mapping. We're going to talk about what the dominant solution today is, which is this idea called page tables. And to illustrate that, I'm going to start with kind of a toy-sized example. So I'm going to have a program where the memory accessible to the program is very small. It has 10-bit addresses. So these are the program's virtual addresses, the addresses the program sees. And we're going to say that we've just chosen to divide up these addresses where we have the lower addresses used for the program's code, then we have the program's global variables and heap, then we have sort of space for extra heap if we need it, and then we have its stack. And I'm going to divide all these addresses into equally sized regions I'm going to call pages. And I'm going to number these regions starting with 0. And I've deliberately chosen these pages I've divided it into to be a size that is a power of 2. In this case, I have 2 to the 8 bytes. And since I have 2 to the 10 sort of total addresses, I have 4 pages that split this memory up exactly. And my use of a power of 2 gives me this very convenient property with my numbering, that since I started numbering at 0, and since I have a power of 2 size, well, if I want to figure out which page am I in, I need to divide by that size. And dividing by a power of 2 is the same as stripping off the last several bits of the value in binary. So we can figure out the page numbers by just taking off the bottom, in this case, 8 bits. So I can just look at the address and do that. And this is going to be very convenient for our processor, because our processor is going to want to figure out a page number very fast. And, well, this is very fast. We just look at the right bits in it. So we have this page number at the beginning of our addresses that tells us which of these sort of blocks we're in. And we're going to call the rest of the address the page offset. So the page offset is going to range from all zeros to all ones, and it tells us where in one of these boxes we're in. So if we're halfway through the code region, that will have offset 100000. You know, and it goes up as we go closer to the end of the page. Questions about our parts of addresses. We have this page number, page offset. Yes?
Does it have to be equally distributed? Because like, I'd imagine a lot of programs wouldn't have code that takes up like,
question, do the pages have to be equally distributed? So the pages are always a fixed size, so they're always the same size, but we don't have to use them for all different things. We could have multiple pages we store code in, and so on, depending on the needs of the program. Does that answer your question? Yes?
So if the top order bits are the page number and the lower order bits are the page offset, what's like the whole number called?
If the top order of bits are the page number and the lower order bits are the page number, what's the whole number called? It's an address. In this case, a virtual address, since these are the addresses the program sees. Other questions? Try, make sure I'm not missing people, I hope. Okay. So, we have our addresses divided up this way that the program sees, and we're going to do the same thing to the real addresses on the machine. So we have physical memory, and therefore physical addresses. And in this example, I'm saying our physical addresses have, we have more of them than the addresses the program sees. And just like I divided up my program addresses into these page size chunks, and I'm going to divide my physical addresses into chunks of the exact same size. So in this case, because I have twice as many physical addresses as virtual addresses, instead of having the top 2 bits tell me the page number, now the top 3 bits do. And I need to decide on my mapping from the virtual addresses here to the physical addresses. And rather than, you know, enumerating every possible address and the corresponding virtual address and the corresponding physical address, I'm just going to assign whole pages, these whole blocks of virtual addresses to a whole block of physical addresses. So sort of graphically, I might say, well, this green page 0 here, this green region, it's going to go to physical page number 2. We're numbering, this is 0, 1, 2. And then page 1 here, this blue one, is going to go to physical page number 7. This one here, the virtual page 3, and orange here, I just haven't chosen anywhere for it to go. So if the program tries to access it, it will get a segmentation fault. And for this yellow region, I've chosen it to go to physical page 0. So this is kind of a picture of what the mapping is, but obviously our OS can't actually just draw a picture and send that to the processor. It's not an acceptable format. So instead, the operating system is going to represent this mapping as a table. So we're going to have a table which has an entry for every virtual page that tells the corresponding number of the physical page to represent this, you know, block of addresses mapping to a different block of addresses. And this is what the OS is going to give the processor so the processor can run our program with the correct set of addresses available. And we're going to call this mapping the page table, or a page table. Yes?
So, like, the physical addresses on the right, like, you have more than you need for the virtual addresses. They're, like,
so the question is, I have more physical addresses than virtual addresses. Is that necessary? Is that arbitrary? That's arbitrary. The most common situation these days is having more virtual addresses than physical. But that hasn't always been the case. Other questions? Yeah?
How is the non-representing?
So the question is, how are we representing none? So it turns out that we're going to represent this by adding a column to represent whether it's valid or whether there's something there or not, and that's how we're going to represent none. So we have this extra, what is, we're going to call a valid bit associated with each row of the table. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So the question is, if I had more virtual addresses than physical addresses, does that mean not every virtual page has a corresponding physical page? So it could mean that, or it could mean that multiple virtual pages go to the same physical page. Other questions? So we're going to have this table, and as I mentioned, well, we can't, you know, we actually want to represent those as bits, so we're going to have this bit to represent whether there's something there or not, and that's going to be how we handle whether there's nothing. We're going to call that a valid bit. And our processor is going to have some machinery that's going to use this table, and every time the program uses an address, it's going to take that address, it's going to split it up into a page number and page offset. It's going to use the page number to go to the correct row of the table. It's going to retrieve that row and get, in this case, the valid bit and the physical page number. It's going to check if the valid bit is 1 or 0. If it's 0, it's going to trigger an exception and ask the OS what to do about it. Otherwise, it's going to take the physical page number and combine it with the rest of the address that the program originally started with. So in this picture, we're accessing what we're going to call a page table entry. So each row of the table, we're going to call a page table entry. And we're going to use the virtual page number to determine which row to go to. And when we look in that row, we're going to get a physical page number, which is where the program's data actually is. And these page numbers represent these big chunks of memory. But we need to know where in that chunk of memory is the program trying to access, and that we get from the page offset, which is the same in the virtual address and the physical address. Before and after the translation, that just doesn't change. Some questions? Yes? Question. Where is this logic implemented? This is in the processor as part of executing every instruction. Possibly multiple times.
And presumably only in user mode.
Question, presumably only in user mode. Typically, this is done in user and kernel mode. So in kernel mode, if they want to access memory that's not in this table, they edit the table. Yeah. Question, are all the pages always going to be the same size? Yes. And generally, the size will be determined by the processor having chosen one. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Comments? Yes.
So if every page is the same size, how can two virtual pages be assigned to one physical?
Question, if every page is the same size, how can two virtual pages be assigned to one physical? If we want to do that, we can just edit this table. So I can just trace this 011 with 111. That becomes 7. And now we have two virtual pages that go to the same physical page. So we can make the table just, the table can have duplicates. That's not forbidden. This is probably confusing if you're running a program. But it's allowed by this scheme, and the hardware will do it. The hardware will make it so when we access one of the virtual pages, it accesses the same memory as the other. So generally, it's not something we will have set up in our programs, but it is allowed by this scheme. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. The question, is there something which determines what each page number corresponds to? Generally, some combination of compiler writers and operating systems decide what the memory layout for programs is, and that's going to determine that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So we have kind of the basics of our scheme. We're going to look at how it works with more realistic sizes. So one kind of thing to mention is that the way I've described the virtual addresses, that the addresses the program uses, it seems like the size of the virtual address is the size of a pointer. And that's not what we're going to say. And the reason why is that often, even though like our pointers might be 64 bits, the hardware doesn't actually use all the bits to determine what part of real memory to access. It doesn't use all the bits in this lookup. So for example, on most 64-bit x86 systems, only 48 bits of the pointer are used. The other bits are checked, but all they're checked for is, are they all duplicates of the uppermost bits? So are they all ones or all zeros? And what this means is that our table doesn't have an entry for, you know, as many pages. And when we talk about the size of virtual addresses, we're going to always talk about the number of bits that are actually used in the table lookup. So, you know, even though we have these extra bits in our address, they aren't used in the table lookup, we're not going to consider them part of our virtual address. Yes? Question, why would they have these extra bits? Why don't they use all the bits? Question, does it matter if the extra bits are all ones or all zeros? The hardware checks it and will trigger an exception if you access addresses that don't have that property. So yes, it does, just because there's an explicit check in the hardware for it. The reason for that check is basically because in the future, they might want to change from 48 to 51, and they want to make sure that programs don't decide, oh, I've had this few bytes in this pointers I can use, and do that. And make it so they can't upgrade their processors in the future to use more bits for the virtual address. Does that answer your question?
Wait, I think I might have missed this. Did you say they could either all be one or zero?
Question, all be one or zero? Yes, they can all be all ones or all zeros. Question, does it make a difference? It does make a difference because one of these bits that has to be all ones or all zeros is part of the virtual, is part of the page table lookup.
Oh, it just takes the highest one.
It just takes the highest one, yeah, and says you duplicate that highest one. Other questions? Comments? Okay. And sometimes you'll see people talk about how big address spaces are. So address space is our name for kind of the view of memory you have if you think of the addresses you have. And we're going to call the amount of stuff you can have addresses for the address space size. And it's going to be based on the number of unique addresses, even though in some cases it might be the case that not all of those unique addresses are useful. So if we have a 32-bit virtual address, we'll say we have a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space. If we have a 20-bit physical address, we'll say we have 2 to the 20 byte physical address space. And the reason I'm being careful about saying it's the number of unique addresses, not the amount of stuff that's actually useful, is that often we'll have, especially for physical addresses, we'll have some physical addresses that aren't useful. So for example, if I have a machine with 3 gigs of memory, well, 3 gigabytes is not a power of 2. But I'm going to have addresses that are, the number of addresses I'm going to have available is going to be a power of 2. So we'll say I have an address space size that's bigger than the amount of memory I have. And that means that some of those addresses must not really be useful, but we still consider part of the address, the physical address space. So typically on a machine with 3 gigs of memory, you know, we'll have a much bigger physical address space size. It's just that not all of those addresses will be assigned to actual memory I have installed, because I don't have enough memory installed to do that. Some questions? Yeah. What happens to those addresses that aren't useful for the physical addresses? Generally the OS avoids using them. And usually there's something that the OS can read at boot that tells it, here's where the memory that's currently installed is at these physical addresses, so it knows what to use and what not to use. Does that answer your question? Question, does that mean hardware manufacturers, when they make memory, try to stick to some sort of power of 2? They do that, but not for this reason. Very often, the physical address size will be way bigger than the amount of memory you're likely to have installed. So it's not that, so that sort of thing, you know, filling it in is not really an issue. Other questions? Okay, so talked about kind of address space sizes and page sizes. Let's do some sort of working on how big things are, and we're going to use some more realistic examples. So on 32-bit x86, they had 32, that's the 32-bit x86 machines with 32-bit registers, 32-bit addresses. Virtual addresses were 32 bits. They used all the 32 bits. And the pages were 4,096 bytes, or 2 to the 12 bytes. So the question is, how many virtual pages does this mean our virtual address space is divided up into? And you know, something that might help us start is if we have 32-bit program virtual addresses, this means we have 2 to the 32 possible virtual addresses. Addresses, or a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space. Questions: how many virtual pages should we have? Someone have an outline for an answer for me? This, or how I would compute the answer? Okay, people who haven't talked yet, but yeah, yeah.
32 minus 1.
Okay, so you said 2 to the 32 possible addresses, and you wanted to divide by 2 to the 12. And a way we can view this is that this is 2 to the 12 addresses per page. And that's going to give us the number of pages. You have 2 to the 12 bytes in a page. Each address represents a byte. And this gives us 2 to the 20 pages. Yes? Question, is the program restricted to only working in the memory of one page? No, because our page table contains a list of dot values for every virtual page, potentially. So as long as there's stuff on the page table, as long as we have, you know, so it can access as much memory as we have valid page table entries, potentially. So it just depends on how big our table is. And in this case, our table seems pretty big. Other questions? Okay, so we have 2 to the 20 pages, and let's say each, let's say our page table entry. So we have a page table, and we mentioned the page table has an entry for each virtual page, so we have 2 to the 20 of those. And let's say we have a physical page number and a valid bit. So the question is, how big is the page table based on, you know, how we, what we've seen about what page tables look like? That picture of valid bit, physical page number. Look at this. So let's do some kind of ranges. So who thinks it's going to be, let's do divide up into, you know, if it's less than 100 kilobytes, less than 1,000 kilobytes, less than 10,000 kilobytes, or greater than 10,000 kilobytes. So let's do a show of hands for which of those ranges do you think this is roughly in? So we think it's less than 100 kilobytes we need. Less than 1,000 kilobytes. Less than 10,000 kilobytes. People, more than 10,000 kilobytes. No clue. Mostly no clue, okay. And other than that, most people said it's kind of in between 1,000 and 10,000. That's what I got. So if we think of the table we saw earlier, we have a number of rows equal to the sort of how many virtual pages. Pages, and in this example, this was 2 to the 20 of them. And for each of those, we had a valid bit, plus we had a physical page number. So the question is, how big is the physical page number? So how can we figure out how big a physical page number? Anyone have an idea how to do that? Yeah. So you say for, we know there's 2 to the 20 of them, so it needs... I'm asking how big a physical page number is, the other thing we have in our... Question, we have 2 to the 20 of them, so we know there's 20 bits. So if we look at table, 2 to the 20 is kind of the number of rows in this table. But we want to know how wide the table is. That's not necessarily based on that. So what we can say here is say we have 30-bit physical addresses. So we have 30-bit physical addresses. We have 2 to the 30 unique addresses. And we can divide by 2 to the 12 addresses per page. And we're going to get 2 to the 18 physical pages. So we need a number that tells us which of 2 to the 18 pages we're in. So we need 18 bits to represent that. So our physical page numbers are 18 bits. Another way we could have figured that out is by remembering the trick we started out with, that when we have a address, so a physical address, we can divide that up into a page offset and a page number. And we're told here that the total size of the physical addresses is 30 bits. So if we can figure out how long our page offsets are, we can use that to determine the size of the physical page numbers. And how long are the page offsets? Well, the page offset tells us which byte of a page we're in. And how many bytes are in a page? Well, 2 to the 12. So it must be 12 bits, because it ranges from 0 to 4,095. And we need exactly 12 bits to do that. And that, if we do the subtraction, means our page numbers are 18 bits, because 18 plus 12 is 30. Some questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so that means our page table is going to be 2 to the 20, so the number of physical pages, sort of rows, times 18 plus 1 bit per row. And this is going to be 19 million bits, or to about, you know, 3-ish megabytes. So questions of how I did that computation? When I multiply by 18, I'm multiplying by, I guess I didn't write this clearly enough, 18 plus 1. Because if we think of our rows here, we have 1, and our physical page numbers in this case are 18. So I get 18, 1 plus 18 going across the row. And I have 2 to the 20 rows, so I'm just multiplying width times height. Does that answer your question? Why not the full 30? Because we're only going to store the page number. So if you, when we have this mapping here, to represent that 0 goes to here, I just stored that 0 goes to 2. I didn't store 0 goes to 2, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. So I saved some bits by doing that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So just to clarify, we use the number of bits in the page offset to figure out the size of the page.
Question, we use the number of bits in the page offset to figure out the size of the page numbers? Yes. So we said an address has a page number and a page offset. So we use that kind of to do algebra to find how big the page number was. Other questions? Okay, so let's do first a little exercise here. So let's say I have this address. Let's split it up into a page number and a page offset, given that I have pages of 4,096 bytes, which is the size I'm going to use a lot because it's what our department machines use. Remember our address, we're going to divide it up. We have a page offset and the page number. Who'd like some more time? Okay. So the way I figure this out is if we know our address is divided up like this, so what I'd really like to know is how big are each of those pieces? And I've told each page is 4,096 bytes, so my possible offsets range from 0 to 4,095, which I means I need 12 bits to hold it. Or alternately, I know there's 2 to the 12 bytes in a page. I need 12 bits to determine which of those 2 to the 12 bytes I'm referring to, because every offset is a different place in the page. So it's just, how many places are there in a page? Well, I have 4,096 bytes. There's 4,096 of them. So questions on that part? So I have to determine my offsets are 12 bits. So now I just need to take the address I have. And split it up. And a trick I can use, which is helpful for this, is that each hexadecimal digit is 4 bits if we convert it to binary. And I went to get the bottom 12 bits as my page offset, so that just happens to be 678. Now, if we had a page offset that wasn't a multiple of 4, we'd have to do something a little annoying and like convert it to binary and get the bits that are part of those bits. But fortunately, 12 is a nice number, so we don't need to do that. Questions? Process. Okay. So, I didn't do that exercise. It's not the one I wanted there. How did I? Oh, okay. So I guess we're almost out of time, so I probably shouldn't do a full exercise. So, one thing that came up on this slide is that it looks like our page table is awfully big. Right, I said we need like a couple megabytes. And maybe that doesn't seem too significant today, but I'm dealing with only 32-bit addresses, and we deal with much bigger. So it seems like this is kind of not really practical to store. And we're gonna kind of have 2 fixes for that. So one thing we're gonna do is that rather than having the page table like be a special set of registers on the processor, we're gonna store it in memory. So we're going to talk about how we store the memory. A second thing we're going to do is we're going to find out that storing the page table as an array of memory, that's still going to be too big. So we're going to need to represent it as something other than a big array, a big table. We're going to have some data structure that's more like how you would implement a map in your data structures course. So the options you might remember are like a tree or a hash table. We're going to use a tree of a particular sort that we're going to talk about next time. And I guess do I have time to do this? Probably not. Okay, so I'll just give the preview of what we're gonna do for storing the page table in memory and talk about sort of some logistical stuff. So for storing the page table in memory, what we're gonna end up doing is rather than having something special in the processor, we'll store an array of integers in memory. And to make this work, we'll have our page table represented as a set of entries that are stored as integers, and we'll just decide how to encode the information in each entry as a number. So in this example, I've arbitrarily decided the upper bit of my number will be the valid bit, and then I'll have the physical page number, and I had some stuff left over because my integers are 16 bits, and that's fine. And we'll tell the processor how to find this by setting a special register in the processor. And we'll do this instead of having a big page table. So we'll talk more about how this works next time. Longer term, we're gonna have an assignment which is about implementing, it's kind of a simulation of page tables. It's gonna be a big assignment, so we'll talk about that next time. Also, it's possible I'll have to not have lab next week based on how far I am in lecture. So, just as a heads up.